So I guess we got a film this week that we have to watch because it's the last wish of a hospital-ridden man. Do you want to tell that story?
Oh, yeah, my friend Wayne. Yeah, poor Wayne. He's now gone. I went to visit Wayne in the hospital a couple of days before he died, and we were just talking about scary movies. And I had mentioned Black Christmas was one that I always, I find it's held up very, very well. And he said, "Yeah, but did you ever see Dementia 13?" And I said, "I never heard of Dementia 13." But it was made in the early 60s, and it is the first film of any note done by Francis Ford Coppola. I'm not going to say it's the first film he ever did because he may have made any number of little films before that that wouldn't have gotten any recognition. But this one is the first one where his name kind of comes to prominence. So Wayne described a little bit of it to me, and I said, "Oh, geez, well, I'll have to go check that out." So we're checking it out.
Yeah, it's one of those things. Obviously, we won't dwell on the sad circumstances, but that is a weird thing, right? Where, I mean, obviously, you have a lot more experience with it than I do, but one of those things when people are, shuffling off this mortal coil, and in some ways, it seems like, oh, this should be such a big thing. It's like, oh, no, I'm not going to see them again. But the reality of it is, like, it's better to just have a normal conversation, right? Not to just, not to make it weird for them. Let's just be cool. Let's just talk like we normally would. And let's talk about Dementia 13. But I was surprised when you brought this up before of like, oh yeah, my friend Wayne mentioned this and, now he's dead. It's like, oh jeez.
And I don't mean it that way that he's dead, but like, oh joy, he's dead. I don't mean that at all. But yeah, we spent that day just talking about just regular stuff. And yeah, this movie came up. So I said, "Well, I'm definitely going to go check that out." So we're checking it out.
Yeah, it's one of those things too. I kind of got the feeling like, when my dad was in the hospital, you kind of have those like thoughts of like, all right, is there any big final things I want to say? But then I started to realize like, that's not going to make his day better. Like, I'd just be doing that for me, it's some kind of weird, like, selfish thing of like, oh, this stuff I want to say. So instead, I just acted like, yeah, we're just normal. We'll just hang out, talk about normal stuff. And yeah, I don't know. I think that's kind of not the worst way to do it. So I think it's kind of cool that you guys were just talking about Francis Ford Coppola's first film. Why not? I got to talk about something. Why not make it fun movie talk?
Yeah, I agree. I agree. There's no point in people getting maudlin and making everybody feel bad. So, and what's the point? You can only say so much. So you might as well just talk about normal stuff, like an old movie from 1963, and from a very famous film developer. And it just amazed me that I had never heard of this before.
Yeah, I never had either, and but I was also, I guess maybe we'll start off with this, where I find I get stuff, I'm surprised sometimes how much stuff gets kind of muddled up in my brain, where I don't realize that I'm conflating stuff. I guess a lot of it is stuff that came a little before me, because obviously Francis Ford Coppola is super famous, so I was always aware of him. But I was looking at the list of movies that he made, and I was like, I'm surprised how few of these I've seen. I could have swore I saw more of his movies than this. And then I realized, oh, I'm conflating Francis Ford Coppola and Martin Scorsese. Like, I always knew they were two different people, but I was never super clear who did what. So I was just thinking of both their movies in one big bucket. And this is clearing that up too, because when I really look at the list, I'm pretty basic on my Francis Ford Coppola. I've seen The Godfather. Very fine film. I've seen Apocalypse Now, which I think you mentioned when we were talking last week, that a lot of people said it was long. I don't disagree. It's very long, but it is also a good movie. And then for some reason, I saw his crappy Dracula movie that he made in the early 90s, which is not one of his best movies. And there was one other one, but I presume you've probably seen more of his films than I have since I've only seen three or four.
Yeah, but didn't I mention to you last week about at the Cannes Film Festival, he has made one and people kind of, there's various reviews. There's the people who think it was really good, and there were a lot of people who think, oh man, he's really gotten weird and old and he may be past it and he shouldn't be making these movies anymore. So then that leaves you with the thought, well, maybe that's true because I think he's 85 or 86 now. Or it could be that a few years down the line, probably after he's dead and gone, people will look at that film and say, wow, that was his greatest work of art or something. Because that sometimes happens after. People look at it from a whole different perspective once a person is passed on. So it's hard to say. And I don't even remember the name of what this new movie was, but it was presented at the Cannes Film Festival just within the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, and I mean, it's safe to say that is a common phenomenon. He wouldn't be the only one that people say that about. But yeah, I think the example we were talking about before was Stanley Kubrick, very similar thing, you know, his final movie. You know, and I don't think people ever came around to being like, oh, it is one of his greatest movies. It's more, I guess, as time goes by, it's like, well, we're not getting any more. Speaking of death, you know, it's like you're not going to get any more Francis Ford Coppola movies eventually. At this point, you're definitely not getting any more Kubrick movies unless there's some hidden in a vault somewhere. So you just learn to appreciate these things, even if it's not their best. You know, it's still in the oeuvre or whatever. But I can definitely see, like, if people... Well, specifically with length, that's one thing that I think ties into this movie is... Like The Godfather, say. I finally saw The Godfather, and it is one of those things. I saw it with my friend Chris at a movie theater where they were replaying it. So that's cool because I get to see it as though it were new. And I was like, wow, that is a movie that holds up like as well as people say. Although there's this whole part where he moves to Italy and he gets a wife, and it's like this whole mini movie inside the movie. And I guess it's because it was in the novel. But it's like, man, you didn't need that. Or with Apocalypse Now, by the end, when it does get all conceptual and dreamy and weird, and it's like, again, I know it's based on a novel. There's only so much you can do, but what the heck is all this? Like, you know, I do think, I sympathize a lot with that specific criticism. I do think most movies could be shorter. So that's what's interesting with this one. This movie is only 74 minutes long because it was a double feature originally. So that's kind of cool. Like, let's see, not only will he be a young, spry filmmaker, but this was also when he didn't have the weight or the name to be able to make a 2.5 hour movie. So this is a quick get in, get out film.
And that's what's sometimes very interesting when you watch early film done by people, because they've become so famous that sometimes whether the movie's good or not, it's the name that's promoting the movie. But in this case, when Wayne mentioned this one to me, and I thought, wow, to actually see something that a guy did at the beginning of his rise to fame. Sometimes those really early things are really, really good because they've got to put that extra effort into them. They can't just ride on their laurels. If that movie's going to become anything, they really have to work at it. It's like when you first watch oftentimes the beginning of a TV series. The first shows are really, really well done because they've got to promote them. And that's why this one interested me, to see, like, what was it like in 1963 when this guy is starting out? Let's, you know, and he has no fame. He has no fame. He has no name. So should be good.
Yeah, so I did a little bit. I didn't do a ton of research. I figured it's best just to let the movie speak for itself. But the little bit I looked in, this also ties into the same way I was conflating Coppola and Scorsese. Is apparently in his early career, Francis Ford Coppola worked a lot for Roger Corman, and Roger Corman was the producer of this, and this was a double feature with Corman's movie X, the man with the X-ray eyes. And on the movie poster, they show this X-ray guy X-raying various things, one of which happens to be a curvy lady. You know? And I was like, Roger Corman, like, isn't that the titty movie guy? But then I realized, looking into Roger Corman, it's like, okay, no, he did make B-movies, and they were kind of violent, and they had hot dames in them a bit, but not to the extent I was thinking. And then I realized I'd also mixed that guy up. To me, Roger Corman and Russ Meyer are all mixed up in my brain.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Russ.
Yeah. Different thing there.
Mr. Sexpot.
Yeah, because I remember I had a cool bartender roommate in Toronto, and he had a projector, and he would just project movies onto the wall of the bar where he worked and just play them, you know, with no sound or just playing music. So he played Russ Meyer movies all the time because they're very stylish and cool and retro. So yeah, I realized also, like, I don't know which ones are Roger Corman and I don't know which ones are Russ Meyer, although I guess if they're extra hot lady filled, they're probably Russ Meyer. But...
Now, speaking of Roger Corman, he just passed away. Just was it maybe 2 weeks ago? He was 96 or 97. And I'm not that familiar with his stuff, but I know the name.
Yeah, I guess all I really know, I don't really know anything about him specifically, but I have looked a bit into that era. And it's kind of neat because even guys who were kind of, you know, famous for grindhouse type movies or for, you know, just like, let's make a double feature with Dementia 13 and The Man with the X-Ray Eyes, you know, like not highbrow cinema. But all that stuff was still way better back then just because, basically because VCRs hadn't been invented yet. So even if you just made a movie that was kind of just there to have some car chases and show some boobs, it's just way better than, you know, by the 80s, we just had, you could just rent porn movies, although they still had plots for a while, but it's just, oh, here's the pizza man. And then after that, it just graduated to the internet where it's like, how about we just have the titties. We don't need stories anymore. So these movies were actually like pretty legit movies back then, you know, they couldn't just make boobs. They had to make a real movie.
Well, sure. And to show up in the movie theater, there were certain restrictions to showing movies in a movie theater because they were public places. So yeah, you couldn't just have tits and ass. You had to have a story that went with it and some purpose for showing the T and A.
So speaking of, that seems to be the little bit again that I looked into this film. So so Coppola, he did help out with a lot of other stuff and made some short films. And even he was trying to, again, just kind of following that route of just whatever I can make that will be successful. So he was pitching movies that were like about voyeurs and sex comedies and stuff. And it just wasn't, no one was biting. It wasn't getting off the ground. But he did enough work on various Roger Corman movies that Corman trusted him. So they gave him something like $40,000. And I guess the idea was to make kind of like a psycho, cheap psycho copy. But Corman just gave Coppola freedom to do whatever he wanted. So Coppola made a way better movie than that. And Corman actually afterward insisted on changes. And it was all just like, just dumb stuff to make the movie worse. Like, we need to throw in a comic relief character to get killed because we need an extra axe murderer and we need 5 more minutes of anything. I don't care. It's just the movie's too short. But apparently in 2017, Coppola made a director's cut. And I believe that's what we have. So we have the version he made taking out the extra lame stuff that Corman put in, which, you know, Corman knew how to sell a movie back then. He probably wasn't wrong if you just want to make a disposable film to throw in a double feature for some matinee or some crap. I don't know. But I think we have the real Coppola version where he was like, I'm going to take this opportunity to make a real movie. And then obviously he proved himself many times over since then that, he obviously always had the ability to rise above these circumstances.
Well, let's check into this thing. And let's check into this thing and see what it's all about, because it's first time I will have seen it.
Yeah, I deliberately, again, like, didn't look into it too deep besides this thing that he was just, his instructions were just make a psycho type movie, so we'll see. That's all I know about it. One thing that's convenient, though, is I was looking around for copies of this movie, and they were all fairly low quality and kind of tough, you know, bad sound and stuff. Ironically, the best version of this that's all cleaned up and fancy pants and the best looking one is just for free on YouTube. So anyone who wants to watch along with us, it couldn't be easier. You know, sometimes we watch stuff like, recently somebody sent me an email about The King of Kensington. I had no idea, but apparently a lot of episodes of that show are hard to find and it's kind of like rare. So the person was like, do you have more? Like, do you have a secret reserve? And I was like, no, sorry, all I had was that one episode. Like, I didn't even know. But in the case of Dementia 13, just type it into YouTube, Dementia 13, 1963. It's right there, and you can watch. Oh, and I guess this just last little note that I realized is to tie Coppola, because I guess the thing with Coppola and Scorsese and Corman and Russ Meyer, all these people were, you know, Coppola and Scorsese were 10 years before me. Corman and Meyer were 20 years before, so that's why it's a little confusing in my brain. But to tie it into my era, I realized that Francis Ford Coppola's daughter, Sophia Coppola, she directed that movie Lost in Translation about Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson in Japan.
Oh, yes.
So that's pretty cool. So because, I mean, you know, I've seen that movie a bunch of times. And you remember that movie we watched, The Darjeeling Limited, about the three brothers on the train in India?
On the train, yes.
his son, Roman Coppola, co-wrote that movie. And the youngest brother, Jason Schwartzman, is his nephew. So even though Coppola himself maybe didn't make as big of an impression on my generation, like I said, I watched his crappy Dracula movie is what I mainly grew up with, but his family sure did. His family is all over the movies that I watch.
Yeah, so he's got a family of a mogul family of writing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And the weird one is Nick Cage. Nicolas Cage is also his nephew, but Nick Cage, that's a whole different story.
Really?
That's a career that is not at all like the rest of his family. Yeah, he changed his name because he didn't want nepotism. He wanted to make it on his own. But yeah, he's part of that family too.
Oh, God. Didn't know that.
But all right, Dementia 13, 1963, available on YouTube. Let's throw that on.
Okay.
John, let's go to bed.
I want to take the boat out alone. I'll be up later.
No, I'll go with you.
What about Hustler?
He met a wax doll. Something he could protect. To relieve his guilt.
Man, that's just reminding me of, I don't know if you remember this at all, but when I was a youngin', we were at your sister Liz's house, and I just remember I got in some kind of fight with my brother, and she had like a pond in her backyard, and I pushed him in. And, you know, like, what if you just suddenly drowned? You know, like, that's kind of what happened here, right? Like, I'm not quite clear exactly. How did the little sister instantly die from being pushed in the water?
Yeah. Let's see, then the mother immortalized the daughter by having those memorials every year. And so that would, the guilt that young fella, and obviously he lied and said he wasn't there. So that was his initial story was a lie. Instead of letting everybody believe it was just an accident, he just lied. So now he's got that guilt. Then the mother immortalizing the daughter and having this memorial thing every blessed year would just enhance what this young fella, the guilt that he felt. And so he becomes kind of a bit of a nutso case.
It is kind of weird. I just saw at the end credits there that it was filmed in Bray, County Wicklow, Ireland, which I only know that because there's a wrestler, Finn Balor, who's from there. But it's kind of weird that they actually filmed it in Ireland and nobody spoke Irish except for that one guy. But anyway, I got some little factoids and details about this that I can yammer about. But before that, do you want to give like just a quick summary, I guess, of the plot as you followed it? I think you followed it better than I did. So,
well, it was difficult to follow, but that doesn't surprise me because you see this a lot in especially British made stories. There's a lot of things coming at you and you can't figure out how they fit in. And then they usually all fit together at the end. So yeah, we've got Louise, the American wife of the older brother. He has a heart attack. He dies of the heart attack in the boat. She's pushing him though. Something about his mother's will, and he doesn't want to have anything to do with it. So I think they have a scuffle in the boat, but he has a heart attack and dies in the boat. So rather than admit that he's had an accidental death, she disposes of the body and then goes to Ireland, where the mother lives in a castle, and is going to maneuver the mother to change her will so that she will benefit. She tells the story that the husband has gone away and is on a business trip somewhere. They've all gotten together to do a memorial for this younger daughter, the youngest daughter, who has died accidentally 7 years earlier. So then things unfold and we get to meet the family and we have the memorial service. We find the mother's she's a little bit weird too, because she's so bothered by the loss of this daughter and that this memorial service has to be just a certain way. But then all of a sudden, somebody starts coming around with an axe and doing everybody in. Louise, who we think is the main character in this story, and actually has quite top billing on the credits at the end. She gets done in immediately, which is a complete shock.
And not only does she die, but then on top of that, her whole plot line dies with her, right? It's like, yeah, never mind the older brother.
Yes, that whole plot line of maneuvering the family. Yes, that's all gone too. So that finished there. Then we've got the caregiver who was around early in, at the time when the young daughter died. We don't know how much he knows, but he's always skulking around. So we suspect he knows more than what we know. But then he gets done in, his head gets chopped off, and he gets thrown in the lake. So then we've only got left the young brother, who was present at the time that the sister died in the pond 7 years earlier, but we don't really know that for a fact because he says he was not there. But we saw a flashback at one point in time where they were out in the yard playing, and so we suspect that he was there when that happened to her. And then we have the remaining brother whose suspicion is coming on him because he's just one of those kind of characters that's a little off, a little, and seems very aloof and doesn't want to be involved in all these family matters. And he's married to a young, beautiful American girl too, or is going to get married to a young, beautiful American girl. The whole thing climatizes at the end. All these suspicions, of course, are raised by various people, by the doctor who attends to the mother, and he knows the family really well. And anyway, the whole thing climatizes at the end after Richard and his gal get married and they're kind of having a little nookie session out in the field. And the doctor is suspicious about, well, all sorts of things. We see Louise hanging on a hook with the slaughtered pigs and cows and whatever. And we see this statue or this doll or something of the young girl who had died in the pond 7 years earlier. And all of a sudden it all climaxes very quickly when the younger son, who I suspected was the killer because he's been a little bothered all the way through, but he's got the old axe and he comes attacking people and the doctor shoots him and story ends very, very quickly. No explanation as to what mental problems he had, which makes it really quite good because we're there to watch the show and watch the horror of the murders and everything and try to guess who it is. We don't really need a whole explanation as to why he did it because that's been unfolding all along. And at the end, when he gets shot and we see that it is him, it all fits into place anyway. You don't need to have somebody tell you that because you saw it happen. You just didn't realize what you were looking at. There, summary. Took almost as long as the movie itself.
Yeah, it's one of these cases where, you know, you can kind of feel that it is somebody's like a very early work because I don't remember exactly how long he took to write this, but, you know, pretty quick. But it's like this weird case where it's like complicated and simple at the same time. You know, like if you boil it down, it's not necessarily that complicated, but as you're watching it, it feels kind of complicated. So it's not that it is complex, which would, you know, be one thing, or it's not that it's very you know, like carefully made in a minimalist way. It is kind of just a muddle in a way, but it's certainly not a bad movie. And I really liked, I was going to say at the very start with that first scene with the older brother dying of a heart attack, just the way it looked that they were out in this boat at night. And because it's a black and white movie, it's just pure 100% blackness all around them. You can't really differentiate the sky from the water and it looks awesome. It's like it's like that comic book Sin City. It's like just black and white. And yeah, that was, in some ways, that was my favorite part, was just stuff like that. Like the visual, you know, you could tell there was some talent bubbling underneath. I think that's, the visuals are what I kind of got into more so than the plot, I would say.
He used that formula a lot throughout the movie too, though. Like an example is after the mother runs away from the little girl's dollhouse because the axe killer is smashing it all apart with the axe. Again, everything is in black and white. The castle scene behind is where she's running back to her home. Very, very black. But she is dressed in a white coat with a white scarf. So she shows up really starkly against that black. You see things like the very end, the girl in the wedding dress. It's a white wedding dress, and the scene all around is dark. the doctor is wearing a white trench coat in the night. Like, the night scenes are very, very black. It's very hard to distinguish shapes and forms and that sort of stuff in the blackness. But the white stands out remarkably. As you go through that movie, you see that a whole lot, that black and white. It's quite a nice technique, and it certainly did. Yes, it was very impressive in the opening scenes. But yeah, he used that throughout the movie.
Yeah, it's definitely better made and better looking than it had any need to be for what it was, especially because, as I'll tell you now, as I was like looking into stuff, it was like really cheap. Like I read earlier that it was 40 some thousand, but not even that. It was actually only $20,000 that Roger Corman just had left over from one of his other movies. So he's just like, hey, can you just whip me together a terrible movie real fast, you know, a double feature movie for 20 grand, which even in the 60s, that's just not a lot of money. And Coppola himself had to raise the other 20,000 just to get any kind of a budget that's even slightly workable. And yeah, just the fact that he made a fully professional, good-looking film under those shoestring concerns, you know, that's pretty impressive.
It wasn't really a surprise ending, though. Remember halfway through, I said, I think it was the younger son, and I said, why? So it wasn't like some of these movies, you're watching them, and at the end, when you actually see who the killer is, it's a complete shock. Like, there's no way you ever could have figured that out. But this one, it wasn't that well hidden from you. There were enough little clues about the actual killer that, yeah, it had to be him. Especially at when I knew it for a fact, is when he said to get to his bedroom, it was so depressing, and he had to go through all these hallways where somebody died a certain tragic death, a grandfather did this, somebody else did that, and you're thinking, oh my God, this runs in the family. These guys have got a whole heredity of weird things. And then you had their mother, who we didn't really see her do anything really strange, but she was so hung up on the death of this daughter, she just couldn't get past it, that you knew that there was some little mental thing going on there with her too. So that was a heredity thing tied into that castle. They tried to make you think it was ghosts from the past and all that stuff, but they were humans from the past who had perhaps ghosts in their lives, but they all suffered little mental issues, which culminated in this youngest son bearing all this guilt because of the death of his sister. It was okay. I liked it.
I wonder if, too, the thing that kept coming back to me from my childhood, because it wasn't really that far removed, is the really early Jason movies, the Friday the 13th movies. You know, you wouldn't really think those are connected so much, but it wasn't really that much later. You know, it was like 16, 17 years after this. So if someone had seen this when they were young, that would be the perfect time, you know, when they're making movies, to have it in their mind. Because in the early ones, there's so many similarities where the story of Jason before it became this weird supernatural thing was just that he was a kid who drowned at summer camp, and the killer turns out to be his mom, who can't let go of the death of her son. And then in the second movie, when it's about Jason himself, he has a shrine to his mom out in the woods that's very similar to this weird shrine they have set up to the sister, with the little, you know, in this case, it's like a weird mannequin of the sister and the different toys of the sister, where in Friday the 13th, it's literally his mom's severed head that he keeps on an altar. But it's like very similar in a lot of ways. Like, I wonder if the people who wrote those early Jason movies, if they saw this movie.
Well, and then you had compared it to Psycho. Psycho, I think, is perhaps so famous because it's not just murder. It is the psychological, what makes a person a murderer, and is delving into the psychological stuff. This is doing the same thing. This is hinting at the fact that this is not just some nutcase roaming around. There are reasons why this son turned out to be the way he is and why he murders. But they didn't get into it in a whole lot of detail. They didn't delve into all the psychology of it, which is same thing with Psycho. They just did it and hinted at it. But these are probably the beginning of those movies, because we've had any numbers of them since then, where we actually have to deal into the psychology of all this stuff. the reasoning behind all of it. And sometimes they get really quite detailed and boring. These are not boring. These just kind of hit you right in the face with it, but tell you, this is just not some nutcase. There's reasons behind it. And you got to think it out yourself. Go back and think, oh yeah, that happened. That happened. They said that. I saw that happen. There's the reasons. And that's why I think they're so successful. They're not slammed in your face with all this psychological information. They make you think about it.
One thing, I don't know if you felt the same way. What was the one guy, the one famous guy, what was his name?
Oh, Patrick McNee. Not McNee. Yeah, the one from, I know him from A Clockwork Orange. It's not McNee because he's the guy from
Avengers. From the Avengers. Patrick McGee. So close.
McGee McNee. Oh my God, that is close.
But what I wanted to say about him, because he is like the one, you know, the name or whatever, the one that people recognize. But what I thought was kind of interesting, I don't know, this could just be a coincidence, but he was my least favorite actor in this whole thing. Like, I feel like all of the no-names, they were all very natural and they were very normal actors, where he was like, I'm an actor, you know, he like overdid every single line. He was of the time. He felt like how someone in a low budget movie from 1963 thinks a good actor should act, you know, where it seems like everybody else didn't, they weren't carrying those kind of pretensions. They were just like, whatever, dude, I'm just here to play a little role.
But I bet if you look back into his theatrical training, I bet you would find he's a stage actor, because that's the impression I got here, is he's acting like a stage actor, where he has to really emote and promote because he's got to reach that guy in the last row of the theater.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. It's just one of those ironies that it's like being too professional or knowing too much about your craft can be a bad thing in some ways. Because, yeah, he was very much like, I am the doctor and I do know of your family's histories. And it's like, no one talks like that. Just talk normal. Everyone else is talking normal. Why are you talking like this?
Here's an interesting thing.
The one famous guy.
I was looking at the credits to see to find his name, and my machine stopped on technical advisor, Dr. William Joseph Bryan Jr. .MD. They actually had a medical doctor advising on this film.
Well, I suppose this could be a good time to transition to just some facts I read about the making of this movie. I looked into it a little more. And it seems like it's basically like the classic thing of, you know, just that Roger Corman, no offense to him and his work, but, you know, he was the schlock guy, the grindhouse guy. And Francis Ford Coppola, obviously, as he showed later in his career, is the award-winning auteur, you know, fancy pants guy. So it was just those two things butting heads of Corman just wanted to make a quick double feature movie. Here's my leftover money. Go make me a thing. And Coppola wanted to make a real movie. And it's weird because I sort of respect both sides, you know, where obviously Coppola did the best that he could to try to make a real movie. But then apparently when he brought it back to Corman, Corman was a little annoyed because this is not, you know, as I said at the start, like this was the second movie after X, the man with the X-ray eyes. And he's like, what is this normal movie? Like, this is going to, for the audience that I'm pitching this to, they're not going to be into this. There needs to be more. So it turns out that the second death, like the first death was Coppola's with the main lady, Louise, dying halfway through. But then the extra death of the Irish poacher, that was the one that Corman insisted on. And you know, it wasn't that bad, but it was tonally a little different. You know, he's talking about, by the histories of Finn McCool himself, I swear to blah, blah, blah. You know, like definitely a little lighter. Although in the director's cuts that Coppola made, he did leave that stuff in, even though that wasn't in his script, but he decided it was fine. So he left it in. However, there's a bunch of other stuff that Corman added in that is not in this version, because Coppola was like, get that stuff out of here. But I kind of respect it, because in a schlocky way, it sounds kind of cool. What Corman added is he added this prologue that was a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist basically talks to the audience and says, you must be mentally fit enough to endure what you're about to see. So he asks a series of questions. And if you go back on the computer, I uploaded a new picture that I can show you that is the D13 test that they did for this movie.
This is to determine if I'm mentally fit to watch this movie?
Yeah.
Are you afraid of death by drowning?
Yeah, so they had, this was the poster, and they handed this out to people. They handed out a questionnaire, and apparently this is what the guy in the prologue said. Are you afraid of death by drowning? Have you ever attempted suicide? Have you ever thought of committing murder? And you could only answer yes or no for any of these. These are some of the questions you will be asked in the unprecedented D13 test to prepare you for the horrifying experience of Dementia 13. And if you fail the test, you will be asked to leave the theater.
So, I mean, that's all like...
So, yeah, this doesn't really fit with the tone. This is way more schlocky and way more, you know, but I respect this in a way, too, because in its own corny way, that's very creative and kind of cool, you know, of like, you know, you get a questionnaire. It's like, you know, there's other movies around this time where, you know, they would have stories of like, oh, someone in the theater had a heart attack. And I don't know if that is probably not true, but they would just spread those things or do not reveal the twist ending. And didn't they do that with Psycho itself? Like, do not reveal the twist ending.
They did. It's that you couldn't, what was the thing? It was real schlocky too. About Psycho. Once you get into the theater, they were going to lock the doors and you could not leave. But, right. But you would want to leave, but you could not leave for any reason whatsoever. That was some of it. And there was more than that, though, keeping it a big secret as to who it was. But mostly it was that the doors would be locked and you could not leave. Because it was so terrifying.
So I guess the D13 test is also just kind of a ripoff of Psycho in its own way. But it's still like kind of impressive. Like I kind of respect both sides. Like I respect that Coppola wanted to stretch out and make like a good movie. But I respect that Corman was like, this is not the business we are in. You know, if you want to go make real movies, go ahead. But I got to sell this movie. And this is how he did it. And it's like, I mean, I think that's kind of cool too in its own grindhouse way.
The one that kills me when you look at this poster, okay, let me look at this girl. She's got very little covering her breasts. You can't see if she's even got a bottom on. They got the big black hand pushing her down. And then off to the side, of course, you get the scary castle with the moon. Look at the size of the moon coming up in the background there. Real Dracula stuff.
That is one thing, though, because you did mention, too, during the movie, there was, like, you know, an occasional sheer negligee or something, but not that much. That's one thing I was actually always kind of disappointed by, in a way, is these exploitation films of the 60s and especially the 70s. They're always way more, you know, it's never as lowbrow as they act like it is. You know, the only one that was Russ Meyer. Russ Meyer gave you what you came to see. It's like, here's just some action and some boobies. But everyone else, it was like, you know, there's a lot of really intense posters. It looks like a cool pulp dime store novel. But yeah, the movies themselves are never, they're never that. They're never all that.
And look at this big sword in Dementia. He's got a sword there. It was an actual axe that the guy used. But this is a very attractive looking sword with blood on the end of it pouring down over.
Yeah, even that, I'm not actually sure why it's called Dementia 13. Maybe dementia by itself is not cool enough. I don't know. That's where this movie kind of lands, is that it is like in a strange middle ground of like, you know, it was trying to break through to be a real movie, but it was coming from the background of Grindhouse, of B-movies. So, yeah, so I don't know. It seems like probably both sides were happier after this, you know, for Coppola to just move on and do real movies, and Corman could just stay here and keep doing non-real movies. Happily ever after. In the director's cut, yeah, so it's interesting that Coppola, he did leave in the groundskeeper. He's like, yeah, okay, that's fine. I'll keep that in. But he did not leave in that intro. So that's why we did not see... Oh, and not only did Corman want the intro just to add some schlock value, but he also just wanted the movie to be 5 minutes longer. Like, that's where his head was at. He wasn't at all concerned about artistic visions and stuff. He's like, this movie needs to be 5 minutes longer. So just, we'll just film, just film a psychiatrist talking to the audience. But yeah, that part is gone. Coppola's like, that is taking that out of there.
And I have to agree, that would be totally unnecessary. That poster reminds me very much of the movies, the other, like the Dracula type movies that were made at the time with Christopher Lee. They always had these kind of posters in them. And some of those Dracula movies were actually quite decent and quite well done. You know, if they're Dracula movies after all. But some of the posters, yeah, they're all these sexy, wild-eyed, blood-dripping teeth. They're very, very similar. This reminds me very much of those.
Yeah, I guess it's just that, you know, it was tough all around. It was tough if you were just trying to make a buck and get movies into theaters that, you know, the people that own the theaters were happy to have. But it was also tough on the other side if you were a, you know, a talent like Coppola who's trying to break out and break through all that stuff. Just everybody had their own struggles, I guess. I guess that's the lesson we've learned here today is that... You know, it's like, yeah, it's cool that Coppola managed to make his way up out of the B-movie circuit. But if it wasn't for the good old B-movie circuit, you know, that's what gave him the foundation. So I think we got to respect it as well. Respect all around.
And a guy like Roger Corman, who obviously knew how to promote this stuff. Because if you tried, especially at this time, you tried to make movies that would be very, very serious, you if you didn't have a catch that would draw in that audience, well, they wouldn't bother coming to see. If you said, here's a very serious movie, psychological study of murder, who's going to go see that? Nobody. But if you have things like Dementia 13, The Test, oh, yeah, you're going to go in there saying, geez, I wonder if I can pass that test. I mean, that's a real selling point. The man obviously had a knack for that. And again, yeah, you got to put it at that time and that place. I know we talk about time and place a whole lot, but you've got to put it in the time that this was created. Nowadays, this kind of thing can be so, you can create such spectacular scenes of fire and blood and everything else through computer generation. But in these days, that wouldn't have been that common to actually see that. And it was a time when, you know, everybody was clean cut. And when you went to town, you wore your gloves and your hat, your pillbox hat. And if you were a man, you wouldn't go to town without your suit on. So, you know, it was very, there were very regimented rules about society. So to actually have shows where some guy might rip his eyeballs out or he'd see women at a dance with no clothes on, like, ooh, that would be like, yeah, I gotta go see that, because it's not something you would see all the time, which it, nowadays it's, you can just turn on your computer and there it all is. So it's that the time and the place really are important for how effective these movies would have been to the public and how they would have been drawn to these things.
Yeah, and it's very easy to like take for granted something that is already successful. Like once you've made a movie and it's made its money back, then you can start criticizing like, oh, they didn't need to do that, or they could have done this, blah, blah, blah. But it's just so easy to forget all of the people who made movies that didn't make their money back and they were done for, you know, and they didn't get to make another movie. You know, we don't know their names, but we do know Roger Corman's name. So yeah, I mean, I respect it. You know, you got to do what you got to do.
He definitely had a salesman's knack of how to excite the public and make them want to go and see these things. Dementia 13, if it didn't have that poster, I don't know, it probably wouldn't have drawn the same number of people that it did. But yeah, there'd be a whole breed of people who'd say, that test, I gotta take the test.